From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thank you on this Mother's Day weekend for joining us. I'm Evan Dawson.
And I'm Megan Mack. We'll open the week in review with a conversation with Governor Andrew Cuomo. It was his first visit on Connections, and we covered a lot of ground.
In this clip with the governor, you'll hear him responding to my question about why he's chosen to support Joe Biden for president. Critics say it's an example of a powerful white man dismissing the potential of a field filled with capable women. Cuomo's answer leads to a conversation about how he views parts of the Democratic Party that want to see substantial change quickly. Let's listen.
Look, I have been one of the most socially progressive administrations. We have the most aggressive women's agenda. I have the first female secretary to the governor, which is the highest position in state government. Appointed women to courts, et cetera. So no, it's not that at all. It's, in my opinion, who is the strongest Democrat to beat Trump is Joe Biden. Why? Because he's the most experienced. I think he's the most credible. I think he relates best to Americans. I think he is a middle-class guy, and he has middle-class values, guy being gender neutral. And I think that communicates, you know. I came from a middle-class community, Queens, New York, and it was very middle-class. And that's who I am. It's ingrained in your culture, right? Working middle-class, blue-collar middle-class. It's your values. It's your language. It's how you move. It's the jokes you tell, although I tell terrible jokes. And I feel that from Joe Biden, and I think that connects with people. Man, woman, African-American, Irish-American, Italian-American, I don't make a judgment through that lens. I think he is the best candidate to beat Donald Trump, period.
He recently told a group of potential donors that he does not view billionaires in this country as the problem. And he's doing that to kind of contrast himself with, for example, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, who have made the argument, essentially making the argument, that it is immoral for a society like ours to have people struggling in poverty and also have billionaires. Do you think it is immoral to have billionaires? And do you agree or disagree with Biden that billionaires in this country are not the problem?
Well, I don't think it's immoral to succeed in earning income. No. And nobody says if the burden is on anyone, the burden is on government and society to make those determinations. Nobody said if you make too much money, you should decide to stop making money or to give it away. A certain tax policy, et cetera, does that. No. So I agree with Joe on that.
Yeah, and your party's sort of having a debate about capitalism, and you had some tough words for those who tried to block the Amazon deal. I know you were deeply disappointed about that, and you sent a signal to essentially the business world saying, we're not going to make this mistake again. But Elizabeth Warren has put forward a plan to break up some of the largest companies, including Amazon, and now one of the co-founders of Facebook says it's time for the government to break up Facebook. Do you think there's too much economic concentration in this country, Governor?
Oh, look, I think there's too much income inequality. That is for sure. And is there something unfair about a system or society, frankly? Forget the system. It's about people. Is there something repulsive about having such poverty, children not having enough to eat, people living on the streets out of poverty? It's more complex than just economic issues sometimes. But yes, is it what we talk about in church or in temple or in the mosque? No, that's not what a good book teaches us, right? Every religion talks about compassion, tikkun olam in Judaism, reaching out, helping people, Matthew 25, Protestant perfect love. Every religion talks about a better society by helping one another, et cetera. So, yes, in the ideal, that's what we should be striving for, and that's what we strive for in the state of New York, by the way. A lot of our government program to do that. We don't want anyone going hungry. We have more housing assistance, more medical assistance, health care. So, yes, that's what we strive for as a society. And that inequality is what is repugnant, I believe. Should we break up companies? That depends. There's a whole body of law on antitrust, et cetera. But my point is, with Amazon, it was all politics. It was all politics. Current politics on the Democratic side, if you wonder, who's more progressive? Well, I'm anti-big company, I'm anti-corporation, I'm anti-business. Amazon shouldn't be allowed to come to New York. Amazon was bringing 25,000 jobs. Average salary, $150,000. In a part of Queens, New York, that we have been trying to develop for 20 years. The whole economy is moving towards tech. It would have been a phenomenal boost. We won a national competition with over 200 states and cities vying for Amazon. And they came to New York to pay the highest tax rate in the United States of America. And it was all politics.
But do you think it was disingenuous politics? I mean, it sounds like you think it was disingenuous.
It is disingenuous. Pardon me for getting frustrated when you bring it up. It was just incredibly frustrating because it was disingenuous because they lied about the facts. The facts were 200 states and cities were competing for Amazon and putting together financial incentive packages, which is what every state and city now does. And then the company sits back and picks the best financial incentive package. We are always at a disability in New York because we start with a higher tax rate. Our package was much less than anyone else. Newark, New Jersey offered $8 billion to Amazon to come there because the value of the 25,000 jobs is so high. $8 billion, right across the river from New York. We offered a $3 billion reduction of the normal tax rate, which is the highest tax rate in the country. Even with the $3 billion reduction, it was still the highest tax rate in the country. And this was over like 20 years. So instead of paying $30 billion in taxes, they only paid $27 billion in taxes. All right. The difference between $30 billion and $27 billion. And the $27 billion is still the highest tax rate in the country. Anywhere else they went, they would have paid less than $27 billion. So that was our incentive package. Okay, you don't pay 30, you pay 27. The opposition said, we're giving Amazon $3 billion. I said, no. They're giving us $27 billion. No, we're giving them $3 billion. No, they're giving us $27. And if they don't come here, we lose $27 billion, as well as 25,000 jobs. That was the argument. It was insane. And by the way, it's more than just a political dialogue. The press has gotten to a place where... And I've been watching this for years. It's amazing how they get into this sort of he said, she said, rather than saying, and by the way, here is the actual truth or the fact. So that was the argument. Governor Cuomo wants to give Amazon $3 billion. Amazon leaves. And you know what the net result is? We lost $27 billion. So now do I say to my friends who opposed it, when they say, I want money for this, I said, well, take it from the $3 billion that we saved when Amazon left, remember?
Well, I hear you, Governor. And listen, as a journalist, I can say that the framing that you offered there, listeners should know, is accurate, that it was a reduction in taxes over, I think, a 10-year term from $30 billion to $27 billion. And you're right, that $3 billion doesn't exist in a pot that you could just give away right now. So that part, you are correct on. Where Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez and others come back and say is they don't like the system. They don't like the idea of having to bid for already existing billionaires who pay their workers, in their view, not very good wages. And I understand what you're saying is $150K on average there, but they're saying, look across the board. Look at Amazon as a company. Look at the standard of living for Jeff Bezos compared to most of the workers. And they're not comfortable with any sort of bidding war in the billions, even if it's just a tax reduction. That the system itself is broken if that is the case. It sounds like you disagree with that.
You know what? I don't like the farming system. I don't like how we treat animals in the food industry. So I'm going to protest, and I'm not going to eat until they change the system, Evan. I'm not going to eat. Or better yet, I don't think you should eat until the system changes. That's what they're saying. I don't like the system. The system is too pro-corporate. Yeah, but we have to live today. And you want to change the system, change the system. Go to Washington and actually get something done.
I think they want you to change the system.
I didn't create the system. And I don't control the system. There were 200 companies vying for Amazon. If they don't come here, they go somewhere else. And they did. And we lost 25,000 jobs and $27 billion because they wanted to play politics and say, well, I'm in my utopia. Good. Good. I understand it. But then change the system. And don't hurt the state of New York and New Yorkers in the meantime. You want to argue for the perfect, for the utopian? Fine. But don't hurt my people in my state. And that's exactly what they did to make their political point.
That's just part of the interview with Governor Cuomo. You can hear the entire conversation, of course, archived at WXXINews.org/connections. Next, we sat down with a young mother in Rochester named Sarah Cheek. She offered a glimpse of what life is like in the most impoverished section of Rochester. The majority of children in her part of town live in extreme poverty. And Sarah uses the services of the Baden Street Settlement, where her four-year-old boy is getting the first part of his education.
We talked to Sarah, and later in this clip, you'll hear Pam Jackson, a former director of after-school programs at Baden Street.
I do think that the classroom is a very strong place and a strong foundation where teachers should be teaching the students what's going on in the world today. I mean, I know he's four, but teach him a little bit about politics and what's going on and things of that nature, because what I teach him at home and what the world is teaching him right now, it seems to be two totally different things.
For a four-year-old, what is the level that you're comfortable talking? You're clearly getting to a point where he's not a baby anymore.
Right.
It sounds like you want to tell him a little bit more about how you see the world.
I mean, and as a parent, it's my job to make sure that he knows right from wrong. He knows what he should and should not be doing. But again, I can only teach him so much at home. Once I open my front door and allow him to go to school or go to daycare, whatever the case may be, they're teaching him something different. So it's important to instill the positive at home and make sure that you're sending him to the proper facilities when he's not home so that he's still learning the right way and the right things to do versus just sending him anywhere because you have to work or you have things to do and you can't really tend to your child at the time. Make sure you place him somewhere where he's still learning the proper things that you're trying to teach at home.
What do you want for his future? What do you hope for him?
To be a successful black man in America. I mean, there's a lot of challenges that he's going to face as he gets older. He just has to have the proper support around him, and I think Baden is a wonderful place to start.
I think that's when you say to be a successful black man in America, right. And then you immediately kind of turn to he's going to have challenges in front of him. Mm-hmm. I want to ask you first how you view those challenges, in particular to black men in this country.
I actually just found out that two close friends of mine passed away this weekend due to gun violence. And I'm not happy with that, and I'm kind of fearful, even though my son's only four and these young men were in their early 20s, that's just a mirror image of what he may possibly have to endure when he gets older. So again, it's all about the beginning foundation of where you start. It starts at home, but then from home, you have to make sure that you're branching them out to the proper locations where they're going to learn, again, right from wrong. I mean, every child isn't taught the proper things at home. You know, you have to, once they step into that building, there has to be teachers there and people who understand that this child is coming from poverty. So we can't really lean on the poverty portion of it, but show them that there's other parts of life besides what you're enduring at home. And if you get the proper education, if you come to school to learn and not cause issues or, you know, not really want to be there, but you're actually there to learn what's being taught to you, you don't have to fall into the realm of what society has going on right now.
Do you think there's a lot of pressure, though, to kind of go in some of those directions? Even if you're taught well at home, even with you as mom, yes. Is there pressure? Is there going to be pressure?
Yes, there's going to always be pressure. Again, some children have the mindset of they were raised and taught the proper things, but just as who they are and what life is influencing on them, they choose to turn the other cheek and go in the direction where things won't be so positive. So it's just a matter of making sure you keep those positive people around you in your circle to push you in the right direction.
And I think the other thing, too, is that we have to make sure we have safe havens. I've seen kids get off the school bus right. and have to pull the pants down and turn the hats around and hide their books just to walk through the neighborhood.
Right.
So you don't want them to become victims either, because bullying is alive and it is growing.
Right.
So we have to provide those loving and safe havens for kids to go to. When you go down Clinton Avenue and you see those kids standing out in their corners and doing negative stuff sometimes, they don't represent all of the kids that live in the neighborhood.
That's right.
In fact, it's a very small percentage. But we can't let our communities identify with those kids, and those kids too. Somewhere along the line, we've got to supply support services to get them off of those streets.
Next, it's Mother's Day weekend. The annual show called Listen to Your Mother was back in Rochester. This year, 13 people performed the stories of motherhood that have affected their lives. It happened at Hochstein, and we asked some of the performers to join us on Connections.
One of the performers goes by the name Marvelous Marvin. His life has not been easy, but he credits his mother with helping give him a chance at real success and happiness. Let's listen.
The strongest person I ever met was my mother. Also, the kindest and the meanest. I guess you have to be when you have four boys and one girl. She showed me what it is to be persistent. They say a woman can't raise a man, but I would say she can help mold one. Honor thy mother and father is what keeps ringing in my ears. Well, my father was a myth. As if he was a folk tale, I heard about him often. She used to say I had his tongue. I never knew what that meant. The young me thought it was a gift until I got older and found out it was a curse. As I look back, I can recall all the times that I thought she was against me. But in reality, she was trying to save me. Wish I had to listen to the warnings on what would happen if a child thought he knew more than his mother. She tried her best to keep me in her grip. She tried to guide me by holding my hand so I wouldn't fall. Somewhere down the line, her hold became loose. Maybe it was the stress. My mother tried her best to keep me out of trouble and off these streets. She was a single mother with five kids and two jobs. She stayed in church and prayed up, as the church folks would say. You see me, I only seen that we was broke. I only seen my mother working her hands to the bone just to make a couple dollars and then be broke again before the weekend was over. She spent all she had to try to keep our family afloat. I only seen I had to be the man of the house. I found it safe around the folks my mother used to warn me about. She used to say, nothing comes out of a fast life but fast death. I just figured she ain't know what she was talking about. All I seen was nice cars, the respect, and the money. I figured I knew more than she did. My mother never drank or smoked before. I tried both. Yeah, I knew way more than she did. I tried to give her some money that I had made, and the craziest thing happened. She ain't want it. She called it the devil's money. I told her, Mama, you're waiting on God, but I'm your blessing right now. Maybe my tone was too high. Or maybe my words was too sharp. Or me just too big for my britches, but I remember the slap to the face. She threw the money at me and told me, never bring the devil's business in the house again or around my siblings. That's the day that everything came crashing down. And when my mother found out I was living the fast life, and she sat me down and tried to talk to me. She said, money isn't everything, and the company you keep paints the person you are. She said, I need to get back into church and save my soul. She found my stash of money and a gun. She said, take them both and leave. As tears fell from her eyes, she spoke clear. She said, sometimes you have to walk through the fire to respect the flame. I didn't understand then, but I do now. Boom.
Is Boom actually written?
Yeah, no, Boom. No, but you know, that's the marvelous ad lib.
Boom.
Boom.
It's like Marvin knows that we're on the radio, so you couldn't see him drop the mic.
But okay, you know.
And also the mic is fixed in here.
Yeah, yeah. So
and the engineer Rob would be upset if he broke it off and dropped it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Rob's going, that was good enough that you may actually get the green light to drop that mic.
Thank you.
Marvin, how did you hear about the show in the first place, and why did you decide you wanted to do it?
I was doing a show at Rochester Speaks, and I actually seen Erin, and she actually came to me and was like, you know, I really think you should audition for this show. And after, you know, seeing everybody, I didn't honestly think I had a good fit. It's some powerful people that I seen looked up before. And got blessed to be with some awesome people, some awesome writers.
Now, you know, your life appears to be in a pretty different place than what you're describing.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know how much of that territory you're also going to explore in your Saturday night performance. But when your mom talked about having to go through the fire to appreciate
to
respect the flame. What's the best way to describe what that feels like, what that means to you now?
Meaning like your mother can tell you all day, don't jump on a bed, but you ain't gonna understand the reason until you fall off. And that's exactly what she meant. You know, she can say all day, stay out the streets. That was the fire. I had to actually put my hand in the fire to understand exactly what she was talking about and why she was saying that.
Marvin, do you think when you talk about your father being a myth more than anything?
Right.
If it wasn't just a myth of a father, if there was a father, do you think that you would have been in a different spot?
No, I honestly thank goodness for everything I went through. Because, mm-hmm. you know, my dad actually, he is a myth. I mean, he's around. I know he's breathing. I know what his name is because I'm the third. But he actually taught me everything not to do. I mean, I'm an excellent dad because of him. I hug my kids extra much because I know what it feels like to not get a hug. And I know my mother was mom and dad, seriously. I mean, she wore the boots and she wore the mittens, you know, but so she actually taught me, you know, how to be a man, believe it or not, by him not being there and seeing her, what she had to do, patience and persistence. That's what she taught me and it stuck.
Let's close the week with the remarkable Jeff Spivak, one of the finest writers in Rochester. Jeff wrote the biography of a Rochesterian named Ernie Coleman, born in 1917, who served at sea in World War II. Ernie almost never spoke about what happened during the war. And there's a reason.
Spivak found out that Ernie was one of the few survivors of one of the worst military or naval disasters in U.S. history. It was the Battle of Savo Island in the South Pacific, and the Japanese Navy sunk multiple American and Australian vessels in a sneak attack during the middle of the night. Ernie could not bring himself to talk about it for the rest of his life. After his passing, Spivak pieced together the story in a book called 22 Minutes. Let's listen.
It was harrowing, and add up what he said with other accounts, and you get a picture of one of the most horrific scenes you can imagine. This battle was only 22 minutes long. The Japanese came upon the American ships unseen, and they...
middle of the night, right?
In the middle of the night, and you described the Vincennes as kind of a pretty-looking little ship, and it kind of was in a way, you know, but... there were some aspects of it that were trouble. Like a lot of ships of that day, they carried aircraft on for reconnaissance. And the first shells from the Japanese Navy hit the Vincennes right where those planes were, which is also the carpenter shop where Ernie was stationed, although Ernie was down below at the time. And all that aviation fuel went up, and before long, you had four ships on fire and sinking. And at that point, all of the ship's functions are quitting because, you know, the power is gone. You can't fight the fires. They're raging. The Japanese were using shells that were timed so that they would penetrate the ships and explode inside the ship, which created even worse carnage.
Oh, that was a detail that I thought was particularly ghastly.
Yeah. So you're fighting an enemy who you don't know where they are because it's dark. The Japanese aren't even using searchlights. Well, they're putting searchlights on the ships, but by the time they're on fire, you don't need them. And as the Japanese admiral who led the attack observed, you know, the Americans were gallant and fighting back, but there wasn't much they could do. And Ernie is picking his way to the, through the debris of the ship and the bodies on to get on deck. He's wounded. They try to put a life jacket on him. He wouldn't do it because he's looking out at the sea and it's all on fire from flaming oil. And he didn't know at the time, but the shark's out there too. And he decides he's going to do something that he had learned to do from when he was a child, swimming across lakes and testing himself all the time, which is he didn't want the life jacket. He just dove into the water. He swam below the flaming oil, came up on the other side, and most of the men there floated for 7 to 8 hours before they were finally picked up. And that was the story that Ernie told to his family at Thanksgiving dinner. And it was the last time he spoke of it, except for various fragments that were almost unrelated, because he, I talked to one of the guys he sailed with, and he remembered Ernie talking about being on the aircraft carrier Saratoga, and this sailor friend of Ernie's thought that Ernie had been on, a member of that crew. Well, no, that was the ship that was taking Ernie back to Hawaii after the battle, and this sailor said, well, that's funny, Ernie never mentioned Vincennes. Guy didn't even know that Ernie was on that ship. So when he talked about the war, he gave you a little piece maybe, but not much.
He was that way throughout his life. He would go throughout his life and he had these relationships and people would never know that he was on that ship.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's how he wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
Do we know once he hit shore what had happened to them at that point? How he got to the daylight hours? I guess we don't
know. Yeah, well, no, but you know, he was hospitalized on board of Saratoga for a while. It was a month before he got back to Hawaii after the battle. And then he was stationed as a carpenter there and had several interesting adventures while he was there too, including going AWOL and flying back to the United States for a weekend jaunt on board an Air Force plane or Naval Air Force plane. And he rebuilt his life. You know, he was a strong man. He was a strong man physically. He was a strong man mentally. And for a guy like him to still be haunted by these kinds of things after all this time just tells you how powerful these episodes can be.
The book 22 Minutes is out now, available at most local bookstores or on Amazon. Hope you've had a wonderful Mother's Day weekend and wherever you're celebrating. I'll just say, love you, Mom. Thanks, Mom.
Yeah, happy Mother's Day, Mary Mac.
Cheryl Burke, Cheryl B., Colleen Dawson, and all of the wonderful mothers out there. You can join us on Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. He's Evan, I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everyone. We'll talk to you Monday.